All right. Good morning, everybody. Hard to believe we're into November, but here we are. In any event, much to talk about this morning, as usual. Some of you may know that on October 19th, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission released an updated Know Your Rights workplace poster. This poster replaces the previous EEO poster, which you know, everybody posted, I'm sure, in their kitchens or their break rooms or whatever. But there is a new poster. According to the EEOC, it's easier for your employees to read. You know, whether that's true or not, who knows? But supposedly, if you look at it, you'll conclude that it uses plain language and bullet points, whereas the other one did not. It also contains some substantive revisions, among which one, it clarifies that harassment is a prohibited form of discrimination. Two, it clarifies that sex discrimination includes discrimination based on pregnancy and related conditions, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And it provides additional information about equal pay discrimination for federal contractors. Interestingly, the new poster features internet links and email addresses, and even a QR code for employees to contact the EEOC if they believe they've been victims of prohibited discrimination. And there's a link to the EEOC's website with instructions for how to file a charge for employment discrimination. So you can see that the EEOC has gone out of its way, certainly, to make access to the EEOC easier. Obviously, you want to post this. You can get it off the EEOC's website. And I think it's important for those of you who have remote workers who don't come in. Obviously, you want to be able to post this on your website or electronically where other employees will have access to getting this new poster. I think you should post it immediately. If you, you know, need extras, you can certainly print them out. You don't have to go to some expensive source to get these. You can get these right off of the EEOC's website. And by the way, they also provide these in Spanish as well as English. So anyway, it's it applies to all covered employers. And as you know, a covered employer is an employer with 15 or more employees. I wanted to mention a change in Maryland law, which ostensibly will make it easier for employees to claim sexual harassment or other workplace harassment because they've changed the standard in Maryland, unlike the federal standard for workplace harassment. So that under prior Maryland law and the current federal law, in order to establish unlawful harassment, an employee had to establish that the conduct was unwelcome, which most of you know, that it was based on the sex or other prohibited classification of the employee, and that importantly, that the conduct complained of was sufficiently severe or pervasive to alter the employee's conditions of employment and to create an abusive work environment. And last, that wrongdoing was imputable on a factual basis to the employer. So this severe or pervasive prong has long been established law. And it also applies in the Fourth Circuit where, excuse me, businesses in Maryland obviously do business. The change in the Maryland law, which took effect October the 1st, is that no longer will the Maryland Commission, for instance, require, in order to satisfy this workplace harassment standard, that the plaintiff or complainant established that the conduct was severe or pervasive. So in other words, it increases the exposure for all of you out there by eliminating the requirement that the conduct be severe or pervasive, like under federal law. Instead, harassment is defined to include unwelcome and offensive conduct based on race, color, religion, ancestry or national origin, sex, age, marital status, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. If one of the three situations described herein apply, one, submission to the conduct is made either explicitly or implicitly a term or condition of employment of an individual. Two, submission to or rejection of the conduct is used as a basis for employment decisions affecting the individuals. Or three, based on the totality of the circumstances, the conduct unreasonably creates a working environment that a reasonable person would perceive to be abusive or hostile. Similarly, the new law defines sexual harassment to include conduct which need not be severe or pervasive, that consists of unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other conduct of a sexual nature when one of the three situations that I just mentioned applies. So really, from a takeaway standpoint, we know that the change in the Maryland law will expose Maryland employers to greater potential liability for harassment claims under Maryland state law than paradoxically exists under federal law. And the new standard approving unlawful hostile work environment harassment is that the totality of circumstances creates conduct of a working environment that a reasonable person would find abusive or hostile, but you don't take into consideration whether any of the conduct was severe or pervasive. So that I think one of the things that you want to take a look at is, well, a few things. One is what your policy states, for instance, in your handbook, when the last time is that you did any kind of harassment training. And also, you know, go back and make sure that your EPLI coverage is up to date, that your limits are up to date, and that you have your defined acts under your EPLI policies broad enough to encompass any of the new standards that are applicable under Maryland law. So it probably behooves you to have a discussion with your broker about this. I had a question that a client raised with me the other day that I wanted to discuss for a minute with you. And the situation was that client had made a tentative offer of employment to somebody, and then the background check showed that the employer applicant for employment, excuse the background noise, sorry about that, the background check showed that this person who had applied and who had been tentatively offered a job was under indictment in a federal court for drug trafficking. Now, the client's question was, can we simply rescind that offer? And this gets to the question of whether you can terminate an incumbent employee or rescind an offer of employment for somebody that you've made a tentative offer to subject to background check. The interesting thing here was that this was not picked up under a Fair Credit Reporting Act case. This was, in fact, reported by one of the people at the client who got some confidential information from somebody he or she knew. So the Fair Credit Reporting Act was not implicated in this situation. And the clear answer is that, of course, most employees are employees at will. They can be fired for good reason, no reason, or bad reason. Of course, we usually advise that there should be some legitimate reason. But it's not unusual to rescind an offer of employment or to terminate an existing employee if, in fact, that employee is arrested or indicted, even if not convicted. You don't have to wait months for the justice system to take its toll on the individual prior to imposing either a job rescission or the termination of employment, which is what happened in this case. Wanted to talk a little bit about the recent Department of Labor proposed rulemaking, which was announced on October 13th, to basically change the way in which the classification of independent contractor versus employee is analyzed. And according to the press release of the Department of Labor, the proposed rule would provide guidance on classifying workers and seeks to combat employee misclassification. Misclassification is a serious issue, they say, that denies workers rights and protections under federal labor standards, promotes wage theft, allows certain employers to gain an unfair advantage over law-abiding businesses, and hurts the economy at large. They go on to say, while independent contractors have an important role in our economy, we have seen in many cases that employers misclassify their employees as independent contractors, particularly among our nation's most vulnerable workers. This was a statement put out by DOL Secretary Marty Walsh. He goes on to say misclassification deprives workers of their federal labor protections, including their right to be paid their full legally earned wages. Under the new rule, here's what the Department of Labor would be trumpeting. One, aligning the department's approach with court's FLSA interpretation and the economic reality test. Two, restore the multi-factor totality of the circumstances analysis to determine whether a worker is an employee or an independent contractor under the FLSA. Three, ensure that all factors are analyzed without assigning a predetermined weight to a particular factor or set of factors. Four, revert to the longstanding interpretation of the economic reality factors. These factors include the investment, control, and opportunity for profit or loss factors, the integral factor, which considers whether the work is integral to the employer's business, is also included. Fifth, assist with the proper classification of employees and independent contractors under the FLSA. And last, rescind the 2021 independent contractor rule. So it's clear, and I've spoken about this in prior telebriefs, that the Department of Labor, similarly to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the National Labor Relations Board, clearly is in a trend line which favors employees and disfavors employment actions by employers that would have an adverse effect on individuals in the workplace. And under this new proposed Department of Labor independent contractor rule, it will be harder, without question, to properly classify an individual as an independent contractor as opposed to fitting in to your employee classifications. Those of you who utilize independent contractors to any extent should go back, look at your independent contractor agreements, and make sure that some of these factors, which I just mentioned, are mentioned either explicitly or implicitly within the confines of your agreement, and that an outsider, for instance, somebody from the Department of Labor or somebody from the IRS in looking at your agreement and in looking at the actual relationship between the putative independent contractor and you as the employer or contracting agent, would similarly view the agreement and the actual reality as being reflexive of an independent contractor relationship. Because remember, the mere fact that you have a written agreement which describes the relationship as an independent contractor agreement does not mean that it constitutes such, and particularly will not mean that under the new DOL standard. So if you have any situations which you believe are sort of on the fence, then take a good look at it, and if you need some help, by all means, reach out. Be happy to help you out on that. Talking about administrative agencies, the National Labor Relations Board is also now considering to change its rule on who is considered to be a dual employer. Now, under the National Labor Relations Act, you might say, well, if I don't have union employees, why would I be concerned about that? And I've spoken about this before, and the reason you would be concerned is because, for instance, if you lease employees or use staffing agencies where those employees are coming from a unionized environment, or you have temporary employees that are coming from an agency, and that agency is sought to be organized by a union, under the new proposed Department of Labor, a dual employer situation, if you have certain criteria, if you are controlling the terms and conditions of employment either in a direct or indirect way along with that secondary employer, it's very likely that the new rule promulgated by the National Labor Relations Board would find you to be a dual employer, and thus subject to either having an obligation to bargain with a union or to defend an unfair labor practice charge which had been brought by one of the secondary employer's employees. So, those are the developments for the day. Aaron, can you take this off of mute, please? Okay, as I always do, I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody would have or any comments. No questions. Everybody is on top of all this stuff. I'm glad to hear. In any event, if you need any guidance on any of these things, then just reach out by email. You can always get me at hkerman@opticherman.com, or you can call my office, 410-209-6417. Thanks for your attention, and we will speak or see each other, at least virtually, in December. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for all the good information.